Hello, and welcome to another edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capitol Week, where we explore and analyze who and what have been making news at Iowa's state capitol, including the governor, lawmakers, and legislation that's in the works or could be in the works, and what it means for all of us. I'm Dennis Hart, and I'm joined as always by Laura Bellin at the must-read political blog site Bleeding Heartland. Laura, good to be with you again on Capitol Week.
Nice to talk with you as always, Dennis.
This is our 15th week together, and this 15th week is loaded, and we need to get right into it. Plenty to talk about. First week of the legislature's overtime session ended last Friday, as you know, with no agreement at all on a state budget. And as of this Monday afternoon, still no agreement. Now, last week, Governor Reynolds had proposed a compromise budget plan. So let's dive into all of what's going on. What's the very latest, Laura?
Well, the Iowa Senate had a subcommittee meeting today where the head of the Appropriations or the Ways and Means Committee said basically was very critical of the House Republicans' proposal on taxes, said that the House Republicans are on an island and that the Senate Republicans and the governor's positions are more aligned and that the House Republicans should go along. I mean, really, when you consider that one party controls all of both legislative chambers and the executive branch, they're really far apart for this stage in the legislative session. Normally, by early April, the House and the Senate would have agreed at least on global budget targets. So that means the total amount that's going to be appropriated in each of the large appropriations bills. And they still don't even have agreement on that. And they also, the tax plan that the Republicans passed in 2018 was already signed into law by this point in May. And they still are pretty far apart in terms of what they would like to do with tax cuts and especially on property taxes and the inheritance tax. So really, it's hard to see. I mean, somebody is going to have to give ground. And given that that the governor is more aligned with the Senate, I do tend to think that House Republicans at some point may have to move their position. But on the other hand, if they don't have the votes in the House to pass some of these tax ideas the Senate Republicans want, then it's not going to pass. So nobody I know thinks that things are going to wrap up this week and maybe not even next week.
What are the big points of contention here? You've got, again, as you've said, and we've talked about over the weeks here, Republicans controlling the House, Republicans controlling the Senate. How far apart are they on which issues?
Well, there are a number of tax changes that they both agree on. And so there are a dozen or so minor changes to the tax code that they agree on. But here are some of the big issues. The inheritance tax, which already doesn't exist for direct descendants, so children or grandchildren, but the Senate wants to quickly phase out the inheritance tax for everybody else, so extended family or friends. And even the Senate Democrats were on board with that. The House Republicans think that would be too costly. That would cost probably about $90 to $100 million a year. The House has an idea of taking the money in the surplus that's about $300 million and just sort of handing it, dividing it and handing it out to all Iowans. So their calculations differ on that, but each Iowan might get $100 or $150. The Senate Republican leader doesn't like that idea, Jack Whitfer. He thinks it should be more targeted rather than spread out in such a way that most people don't get what would be a significant amount of money for them. There are also another huge issue relates to the property tax. So right now, the mental health system in Iowa is largely funded through property taxes. And the governor has been wanting to do something about that. And some advocates in the mental health community agree that it would be better to shift this away from property taxes. So the Senate Republican plan and the governor's plan would remove the mental health funding from the property tax rolls. And then it would there would be a special state appropriation for that system. Simultaneously, so then they say, well, that's going to lead to property tax cuts all over the state. It's a little more complicated than that because they also want to phase out this what's called the backfill, which is the state support for local governments that replaces the money they lost because of the big commercial property tax cut in 2013. And so if the state, you know, they take away this burden of funding mental health on the one hand, but then they also take away the backfill on the other hand, the upshot is that a lot of local governments probably will end up raising their property taxes anyway. But so that's a big a huge change. I mean, for decades, we've had this, the current system for funding our mental health. And so it's kind of a leap of faith when you think about it, that you want to put that obligation on the state budget. And I think that's where the House Republicans are coming from. They are concerned that we may not have the future revenues to support that change. And they're also very concerned with phasing in some of the other tax cuts, as I mentioned, like the inheritance tax, that would create problems 3, 4, or 5 years down the road. So right now, the House Republicans are not on board with this big property tax shift for mental health funding. And that's just something, you know, it's hard to find a middle ground between those two positions.
You've covered the legislature for a significant number of years. Have you ever seen them this far apart this late in the sessions?
No. I mean, when the Democrats had the trifecta for the first 4 years I was writing at Bleeding Heartland, the Democrats controlled both chambers. And they did have significant differences on tax policy. And in fact, in 2009, the Senate passed a very ambitious tax reform plan, and they just didn't have the votes for it in the Iowa House. And it just ended up dying. They really didn't do anything on taxes. And I mean, I remember that they were negotiating on some of the things, the infrastructure bonding program. I mean, there were things that went back and forth, but they never went into overtime to this degree. And they were never publicly arguing with each other to this degree. And during the 6 years where Republicans controlled the Iowa House and Democrats controlled the Iowa Senate, obviously they had a lot of big differences on policy. And most of those legislative sessions did go well into overtime. But I feel like because it was so clear that they were far apart, it almost helped push people toward grand bargains. So for instance, in 2013, I had mentioned that commercial property tax cut. That was a big priority for the House Republicans and Governor Branstad at that time. And the Senate Democrats really didn't want that. They said that the property tax cut would mostly benefit large out-of-state companies like McDonald's and Walmart's. And so they resisted that. And what ended up happening is there was a grand bargain at the end of the 2013 session where the Democrats got the Medicaid expansion that they wanted related to the Affordable Care Act, and the Republicans got this big commercial property tax cut. And so what I'm not seeing now is any kind of big grand. I think the governor was attempting to put forward a grand bargain, but her grand bargain was really more closer to the Senate's position. So I don't think there was enough in there for the House Republicans to bring them on board.
So what's the way out of this? In other words, if there's no grand bargain, do they just essentially end it at some point out of exhaustion, or where does this go?
Well, I don't know. I mean, they don't really have to concede. In 2011, they went all the way up to June 30th, which is the very last day of the fiscal year before they agreed on a health and human services budget. So that was down to the wire. We were facing potentially a partial state government shutdown if they didn't get that budget passed by July 1st. But I don't think it'll become that dire. I mean, I think that the budget side of it, they probably will reach agreement on the budget bills sooner than on the tax things. I don't think that they want to go home without a tax deal, like what happened in the 2009 session where the House and Senate Democrats couldn't agree on on tax changes. And so they just went home and left that unfinished. I think that Republicans are highly motivated to be able to tell their voters that they did something to cut taxes. And certainly the governor wants to be able to say that she addressed this mental health system in a historic way. So but somewhere, I mean, somebody's going to have to blink, and I'm not sure. I mean, right now, I guess, like I said, I would think that the House Republicans might feel more pressure to blink, but I don't know what they really want in exchange. And Pat Grassley wasn't giving up a lot in his last little media availability with journalists. He wasn't conveying very well what's the price for House Republicans for going along with some of these changes. He was just saying, well, we're very cautious and we want to make sure that we don't, give up too much, and we want to have those guardrails in place. So it's not really clear what he's asking for.
How will this all end? Well, stay right here on Capital Week and you'll find out.
Yeah.
Every week. Well, there was action last week in the legislature. Let's talk a lot about what they did. The Senate passed the so-called vaccine passport bill. Controversial, says Iowa businesses cannot ask for proof of vaccination from customers. Bill had already been passed by the House. Governor expected to sign it. But as you reported on Monday afternoon, anti-vaxxers in the state hate this anti-vaccination bill. Let's unpack all of this mess.
So there are a couple of leading groups that have been opposing a lot of the COVID-19 mitigation policies over the last years. And one of them is called Iowans for Freedom, and another one is called Informed Choice Iowa. Informed Choice Iowa is really more focused on the vaccine issue than anything else. But Iowans for Freedom is focused on the whole range of mask requirements and, you know, the capacity limits and lots of things. So they have been upset for months about this idea that people would be forced to get COVID-19 vaccines. And, you know, the Democrats in the House and Senate have been shaking their heads a little bit and saying, nobody's proposing. I mean, the federal government's not proposing vaccine passports. State and local governments aren't proposing it. I really don't know of any businesses. I mean, there may be some small businesses somewhere that wanted to require vaccines, but I haven't heard of any Iowa-based companies or venues that talked about restricting access only to people who've had a vaccine. I mean, it just, it doesn't really seem to be a live wire, but people have been very concerned about it, loudly so. And so last month, the governor came out and said that she wanted the legislature to address this issue. I mean, it was a little bit late in the game. It was past what they call that funnel deadline, where you're supposed to have all non-tax and non-budget bills, but when leadership wants to pass something, they can introduce it whenever they want. So the governor said that she wanted this vaccine passports bill, and they drafted one in a hurry. The problem was, from the perspective of the anti-vax crowd, is this bill had, first of all, it didn't cover employees. It only covered customers. So it doesn't say that businesses can't require their employees to be vaccinated. Now, I don't know about any Iowa businesses that are requiring employees to get vaccinated, but in any case, if they wanted to, this bill doesn't prevent it. And it also says that they can't require that customers or clients be vaccinated, but the penalty for violating that is that businesses would lose any grant or any contract with the state. Well, as you know, most private businesses don't enter into contracts with the state and aren't receiving any grants from the state. So, you know, theoretically, if I'm a business owner, I could still require that customers show their vaccine card. I mean, I doubt anyone would do that because it would really limit their customer base and make a lot of people angry. But so the bill doesn't have a lot of teeth, and it exempts healthcare facilities. That's the big issue for the anti-vaccine activists. So mainly that is intended to cover hospitals and nursing homes, but also it covers really any kind of residential facility, assisted living, group homes for people with developmental disabilities. And that has made people really upset in the anti-vax crowd. And so when they had the House and Senate subcommittee hearings on this bill, even though it was supposed to be this great step for freedom from being forced to get a vaccine, almost all of the speakers at these subcommittee meetings were the activists saying, don't pass the bill in this form, either amend it so that there's no exemption for healthcare facilities or kill this bill because this is worse than doing nothing. So it was really, really quite striking to hear how passionate they are about the issue. And again, these are the people who are most concerned about COVID-19 vaccines potentially being required. And they're the very people who don't support this bill.
As you and I have talked, the anti-vaccination thing, the anti-vaccine passport thing has been a big part in Republican legislatures across the nation. And it seems to be, in some ways, part of their reaction to what they perceive to be cancel culture. This is a way of firing up their base against something that is not being pushed by the federal government. It's not being pushed by any state governments I'm aware of. In other words, it's almost a made-up issue.
Yes. And I mean, the point about protecting employees was interesting because the main House Republican, the floor manager of this bill, Stephen Holt, who chairs the Judiciary Committee, he was saying, look, you know, I respect people's freedom to choose not to get a vaccine. But on the other hand, a business owner has the right to run their business. So he said, I've got an 80-year-old woman in my district who owns a dress shop. And if she wants to say that her employees need to be vaccinated to protect her own health, you know, who am I to tell her that she can't? So it's really almost a private property rights issue from that perspective within the Republican Party. But then there are people who want to recognize more of an absolute freedom for people not to choose a vaccine. Of course, I mean, there's no right to work at any specific enterprise, right? I mean, if your employer says you have to get a vaccine and you don't want to get one, you can always go try to find another job.
it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. You do expect the governor to sign this, right?
Oh, sure. I mean, she's already been saying on her social media that she can't wait to sign this bill. And she, on her, the Fox News town hall that they did 10 days ago or so with the Republican governors, I mean, she said there that she expects the bill to be on her desk and she expects to sign it. So she did meet with one of the legislators who opposes the bill on Friday, but she's definitely signing this bill. And, but the interesting thing is, I mean, she's going to tout this bill as a victory for people who don't want to be forced to get vaccinated. But again, the main people who are concerned about that issue aren't excited about the bill. So I don't know what is where it's going from here. And I mean, the Republicans did say that they'll revisit the issue next year if it turns out that there are a lot of problems with employers forcing people to get vaccinated against their will. I mean, I just haven't heard of big Iowa employers doing that. I find it very unlikely that that would happen. And certainly unlikely that healthcare facilities would refuse to provide services to people who are unvaccinated or would refuse to let them visit their relatives in nursing homes.
Speaking of the governor signing a bill, she signed one this Monday afternoon that ends the voluntary diversity plans that school districts in five cities in Iowa, Davenport, Des Moines, Waterloo, West Liberty, and Postville, have used for years to regulate open enrollment in their districts. So it ends voluntary diversity plans, and this is going to have an impact on those districts and on parents. So let's talk about that.
Yes, so this is relates to open enrollment. And normally, if you live in a certain public school district and you want to enroll your kids in a different school district, you have to apply before March 1st, and then you have to get approval from your school district to do that. And certain, it's a very small number, as you mentioned, the districts that you mentioned, but they include Des Moines, which is by far the largest district in the state, and Davenport and Waterloo are also significant size in the top 10. That they restrict open enrollment for some families. So for instance, if you were a white family living in certain neighborhoods of the city, you might be turned down for a request to enroll your children outside the district because they want to maintain a more diversity in their schools. And you know, one of the problems with this bill is that they not only eliminated these voluntary diversity plans, but they made the bill go into effect immediately. And they also retroactively revoked this March 1st deadline. So now there will be families who can apply right now to open enroll their kids out of the district starting in August. And yet school districts in Iowa are required to approve their budgets by April 15th. So school districts all over the state have approved their budgets based on the enrollment numbers they were expecting. The state has already approved a per pupil state aid based on the enrollment that schools were expecting. And now it could be that it possibly hundreds, certainly dozens or possibly hundreds of students may end up enrolling in other school districts. So the districts are going to lose a lot of money. I mean, the projection right now is that the Des Moines public schools could lose $2.6 million. Davenport schools could lose $700,000. I mean, that there's no way to really make up that hole in the budget without cutting some staff or cutting some programs or both.
So what was the point of Republicans in passing the bill?
Well, I mean, generally speaking, the Republicans have shown this year that they're hostile to policies that are geared toward diversity and promoting diversity. And I think that within the Republican base, there are a lot of white people who don't like the idea that that concerns that of other non-white ethnic groups perhaps should be centered in the conversation. And so I think that there is a small but loud a group of families that want to open enroll out of these districts, and they don't feel that they should be restricted based on a broader research about the benefits of having a diverse student body, for instance. You know, so they just feel that ultimately the parents should be the only deciders, and they don't respect the whole concept of having a policy that tries to promote a diverse student body.
Well, let's stick with the governor and with schools. Before we do that, I want to say it's about 18 and a half, 19 minutes after the hour, and you are listening to Capital Week. This is KHOI Community Radio's weekly show involving me, Dennis Hart, and Laura Bellin. We talk about what went on at the state capitol. And gosh, there's always a lot going on at the state capitol. We've never had a show where we've had to fight for information here. We try to get it all in. It's been quite a week. Governor defended her decision. Controversial decision last week, she defended it to turn down $95 million in federal money meant for coronavirus testing in school said there's already enough money to conduct the needed testing. And then the Department of Public Health Interim Director Kelly Garcia said that federal officials told them that testing for students and teachers is a priority, but that schools had not requested money for testing. So the governor turns back $95 million. The question is, did schools even know there was money there for testing that they could have asked for?
Well, that's the question that I've been asking, and I've asked the Department of Education as well as the Department of Public Health, because I was given that same answer that, well, we haven't had any school districts put in a request for funding. And I said, well, were they offered the funding? Because I think that if you told a lot of school districts, hey, we could have this money available for you to do routine testing once a week or every other week. And also, this wasn't just for the current school year. This was something that they could have used for summer sports or other activities. They could have held back some of the money and used it in the fall in case we end up having more of a problem with spread of some of the variants of concern. So there were ways that the money could have been used to support PPE in schools, to support infrastructure for lab testing facilities. So, I mean, really, it doesn't seem like they thoroughly evaluated all of the things that could be done with the money. And actually, Senate and House Democrats requested an oversight committee meeting on this decision to turn down the money. And the Republicans who chair those committees in the House and Senate said that they just weren't interested in exploring that. They described that as just a political distraction to look into that. But when you think about it, I mean, an oversight committee, if you're not going to examine a decision to turn down $95 million, I mean, what kind of decision would you really look at? Because it does seem very questionable. And I haven't gotten a solid answer on whether school districts were offered this money before the state decided to reject it. The governor did say one other thing at her press conference last week. She said, you know, we can't just keep taking all of this money. It gets expensive. But when Dave Price of WHO TV asked her, well, is there any other money that you've turned down from this federal COVID-19 relief package? And she said there wasn't. So the state of Iowa as a whole is going to get about $5 billion out of this latest bill, the American Rescue Plan. And the state share of that is about $1.4 billion. So the governor hasn't turned down any of that money. So she's only turned down $95 million. I mean, it's a lot of money, but it's not a lot compared to the $5 billion. So it really doesn't seem to be a decision that was driven by any sort of fiscal concerns about overspending by the federal government.
Yeah, and we talked last week. I'm wondering, and we talked about this briefly, would she have turned back the $95 million if a President Trump had offered it?
Yeah, that's hard to envision that Iowa would have turned down money from a Republican administration. It is very hard to imagine.
Yes, it is. Let's stick with the governor, because she's done a lot. Said last week that her call to bar transgender athletes from competing in girls' sports is an issue of fairness. That's what the governor said. And she disputed critics' claims that the proposal sends a hurtful message. Now, earlier, as we know, we talked about this last week, she had told Fox News that she hopes she'll be able to sign a bill this year banning transgender women and girls from competing in women's and girls' sports. She was asked if she could give a single example of a case that prompted discussions with state lawmakers about such a ban. She did not offer a single example. So is this a culture war thing? What's going on with the governor on this one?
Well, this, keep in mind that, I mean, this is, the governor has been there since 2017, and she's never, before a couple of weeks ago, she's never said that she wants to take action to bar transgender participation in sports, the high school and college level. So this is a brand new thing. And it is happening around the country, and there are Republican strategists around the country who have said, I mean, they have said openly that they view this as a wedge issue where they might be able to get some support back from suburban mothers and people who care, who have girls in school and care about sports. But honestly, I mean, there are very few cases anywhere in the country, and I'm not aware of any in Iowa where a transgender girl has dominated sports competition. I mean, the governor said something last week about how girls should be able to compete for scholarships to continue their education, but I'm not aware of any trans kids winning any athletic scholarships in the state of Iowa. So I don't think that anyone really sees this as a problem, a current problem in the sports world. I mean, the Iowa Girls and Boys High School Athletic Associations, they have allowed a transgender participation for a number of years, and it just doesn't doesn't come up. Now, I've had a few readers ask me, well, is this also going to ban girls or trans boys from participating in boys sports? We don't have any language for this bill, but I don't think so. The two bills that were introduced earlier this year that didn't advance out of committee, both of them were specific to restricting the biological males, I think was the way the wording was somewhat different in the bills, but it was restricting biological males from participating in girls sports. We already have girls participating in boys wrestling. There have been a few girls who qualified for the state wrestling tournament even. And so I don't think there's any chance that this bill is going to bar either girls or trans boys from participating in boys sports. I think the entire focus will be on trans girls. And it's really, it does send a hurtful message. I mean, we do know from research around the country that a lot of transgender teens feel very isolated and have higher rates of suicidal ideation than other teenagers. And, you know, this is just something that really, it just seems to gratuitously say, you're not welcome and we don't want you here.
It's interesting, and I'm wondering from your perspective, having covered the legislature for a while, a long time, have you seen a year similar to this one in which cultural issues that do not appear to be actual issues, transgender, diversity training and language and diversity training, cultural issues, in terms of fighting universities, sending messages to universities about maybe banning tenure and all of this. Have you seen a year like this before, or are we at a peak right now in terms of this cultural fighting that's going on?
This is different even from the Republican trifectas of 2017 and 2018. As I think we discussed earlier in the year, there have been bills introduced to ban tenure for a long time. This was the first year that anything like that got out of a committee. Usually it never even got a committee hearing. The other bills targeting the universities, I mean, there may have been a few bills introduced like that, but again, nothing that would get to the point of through a committee and debated on the floor of a legislature, of a chamber, and even now with the diversity training going to the governor. And I feel that the Republicans have always been conscious of passing bills that are important to segments of the base. And so that's why in 2017 and 18, you saw immediately the attacks on organized labor, the pro-gun bill, the bills restricting abortion, multiple bills restricting abortion and targeting Planned Parenthood funding. And so that, you know, you could say in some respects that those are part of a culture war, but those are, I think, a little bit different from some of the issues that they've discussed this year that are really more theoretical, like the issue of trans participation in sports. I mean, there are just a very small fraction of high school and college athletes in the state of Iowa are transgender. So it just is not something that affects a lot of people's lives. And the diversity training, I mean, I feel that that's somewhat of a reaction to the Black Lives Matter movement. That seems to have really upset certain Republican lawmakers, that they just in general, and like we saw with the bill that was introduced, it didn't get passed in the House, but it did get through a subcommittee to ban teaching of the 1619 Project, any material from that curriculum, to ban teaching at the high school or even the college level. You know, it's really an extreme overreach of the government. I mean, we've never had the legislature try to get involved in that level of decision-making about a curriculum before. I mean, there have been laws that addressed aspects of the curriculum, like when the Democrats were in control, for instance, they passed a law that said sex education curriculum has to include medically accurate information. But it wasn't, you know, they didn't say like specifically this or that, you know, can't be taught.
Yeah, and all of this seems to line up with the idea that these are Trump supporters, many Republicans now, most Republicans. The president, former president, is still perceived to be in control of the party, as a witness what's happening with Liz Cheney this week in the House. She's going to be stripped of her leadership post. So do you think this is the Iowa legislature, Republican members, just saying, okay, President Trump, former President Trump, controls the party. Here's what he believes. This is the only way we can survive, is by catering to his base.
I think that there's a lot of truth to that. And then I also think, frankly, there are a lot of newer legislators. There were a larger than usual number of Republican retirements, especially in the Iowa House in 2018 and 2020. And the Republicans swept most of those open seat races. And so you have a lot of very new Republican lawmakers. So they're not steeped in the culture of how things were done before. Many of them strongly support Trump and believe that they owe their elections to Trump. And that might not be an off-base view, given that Trump certainly did have coattails in most of the state. And so I think that they view themselves as representing that part of the party and not the old-fashioned business wing. So, for instance, with this, the transgender, the bills targeting LGBTQ, as we talked before, that the business community is very against these bills because they feel that it sends a bad message. It might discourage the NCAA from having tournament events here. It might discourage investment here, or it discourage companies from locating offices here. But to a lot of these legislators, they don't care because the old-fashioned Chamber of Commerce, Country Club Republicans, they don't view themselves as part of that. They view themselves as more, you know, representing working class issues. And I mean, you could argue about whether the economic policies they support really do support working class Iowans, but they see themselves that way. And that, for instance, is one reason why there was a bill on trucking industry immunity that it's gotten bottled up in the Iowa House and it's still bottled up. I think that they don't have the votes, partly because there's this core group of members who view themselves as representing working men and women and not the old-fashioned Republican establishment.
It is 31 minutes past the hour, or if you like it another way, 29 minutes before the top of the hour. I'm Dennis Hart, along with Laura Bellin. This is KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week. Laura, let's talk about the Federal Election Commission asking Congress to keep campaigns from pre-selecting. And this is a little complex. I'm going to ask you to download it in just a minute. Pre-selecting the recurring gift option in online contribution forms. Now, the Governor Reynolds, in Iowa's first congressional district incumbent Ashley Hinson did that this year. Why is this significant?
Well, if listeners out there have donated to a political candidate before, typically you click through, you go to the page, you can select the amount you want to give, and there's an option where you can choose to make that a recurring monthly gift if you want to. And candidates and campaigns, of course, they love those recurring gifts because that allows them to plan their budget better. And the Trump campaign took a different step on this last year, where on some of their fundraising pages, those boxes selecting a recurring monthly gift were already checked. And then they added a second box, which people in the campaign finance world call a money bomb, that would just have a specific date. You would pledge to give an additional amount. The first time they did this, it was for Trump's birthday on June 14th of last year. And it ended up being a record online fundraising day for the Trump campaign, because so many people who had given at some other time also made an additional gift on June 14th. So what happened, though, is that the Federal Election Commission started getting this wave of complaints because people were noticing in the fall that they were getting these recurring debits from their account and they didn't recall having authorized these gifts. And so they felt that it was some kind of fraud. Well, it turned out it wasn't exactly fraud. It was just the Trump campaign was collecting on all these recurring donations and money bombs. And so that's the Federal Election Commission is kind of short-staffed already. So they got an avalanche of complaints and there were a record level of refunds, hundreds of millions of dollars in refunds that the Trump campaign gave to its own supporters late last year. Mostly those happened after the election. But so the Federal Election Commission, they hardly ever agree on anything. I mean, usually partisan deadlock is standard operating procedure. So when I saw last Thursday that all of the commissioners recommended that Congress ban this practice, I thought, wow, that is really a strong statement coming from that commission. So what they would want is that federal campaign committees and political committees could not automatically opt you into a recurring donation and say you have to uncheck that box. They would have to just have the option on the page so that those who choose to give recurring gifts could do that, but they wouldn't have to do that. And that would eliminate this problem of people unwittingly or unknowingly signing up to give again and again and again to campaigns. So I had noticed in April that the governor's campaign is doing this. And then later the same month, I noticed that Ashley Hinson's campaign was doing that. I still have not gotten a comment from either of those campaigns on why they are planning to do it or whether they're considering changing the practice. I know every 2 or 3 days or so, I click through on one of the fundraising links just to confirm that they're still doing that. So I can say as of yesterday, the governor's campaign the contribution page is still, if you click through and sign up to make a gift, it'll, unless you uncheck those boxes, you'll be making that same gift every month. And you'll also be making an additional gift on a specific date. Right now it says May 15th, but after May 15th, it'll probably say May 30th or some date in June.
Laura, I myself would like to have a money bomb box that you can check. If I can get one, would you check it?
If I noticed it was there, okay. I would. Automatically opt me into that. Well, one thing
sure
that I should also mention that if Congress does act on this, and that's a big if because Congress doesn't often do significant campaign finance reform, but if Congress were to take the FEC's recommendation and say, no, campaigns can't do this, that would only apply to federal candidates. So candidates for president, U.S. House or Senate. So it would be up to the Iowa Ethics and Campaign Disclosure Board on whether they wanted to try to regulate that for state candidates like Governor Reynolds. And I've saw a comment from them. I've not heard back from the Iowa Ethics and Campaign Disclosure Board on whether this practice is something they've discussed or perhaps will discuss.
A couple of more things before our friend Mike Murphy joins us on Capitol Week here. The state Supreme Court sided with the state auditor in a dispute with the Board of Regents over a University of Iowa contract. Talk about that.
This was a really big deal. And the state auditor, Rob Sand, said he called this a massive win for taxpayers. But I would say, you know, it's a massive win for anybody who wants to know what's going on at the state universities. About a year and a half ago, so it was in December of 2019, the Iowa Board of Regents and the University of Iowa announced a massive public-private partnership for the state, for the university's utility system. And they signed a contract with a couple of French companies and some unnamed, supposedly Iowa-based investors, where the investors were putting up about $1.1 billion up front. And then they would get the right to operate the utility system of the university for 50 years. It's a really long contract. A 50-year contract is not very common. And the University of Iowa is going to get this big lump sum up front, and then they're going to be on the hook for the next 50 years, paying a certain amount. It's going to be an increasing amount back to this consortium of companies that will be operating the system. So, of course, you know, it created a bit of an uproar at the university because in some ways it's like a gambling and rolling the dice on the stock market. I mean, if they invest this $1.1 billion well, they could end up with a lot of money that could fund a lot of university programs. But if they lose money in the market, then the state might end up having to step in and bail out the university. So state auditor Rob Sand right away said, you know, I want to know more about this deal. And the university and the Board of Regents just said, well, no, you know, it's confidential information. And normally rules on confidential information don't apply to the state auditor's office. So he went ahead and issued a subpoena and he went to court to enforce that subpoena. And the district court did side with him, but the university and the Board of Regents appealed to the Iowa Supreme Court. And it's taken just this long amount of time to work its way through. But it ended up being a unanimous ruling from the Iowa Supreme Court justices that the state auditor has the authority to audit not just annually, but as often as the auditor deems necessary, any governmental unit, and that includes the University of Iowa. And they even mentioned that just the scale of this utilities deal, it's really one of the biggest contracts that a state entity has ever entered into, that does weigh in on the side of more transparency and allowing the state auditor to review this. Now, the deal has already been signed. It was finalized in March of 2020, but we still don't know who those Iowa-based investors are. We don't know if there were any conflicts of interest, and there are a lot of other financial aspects of the deal that we don't know about. So I think many people who are watching the universities closely are going to be looking forward to that state auditor's report that is going to give us a lot of information. And I think it's a big warning sign to the Board of Regents that they are going to need to be more transparent in any future dealings involving any of the state universities.
One more quickie. Matt Whitaker returned to Iowa last week, and that generated shudders of excitement in some people and shudders of fear and loathing in others. Tell us why, Laura. Who is Matt Whitaker?
Matt Whitaker was a U.S. attorney in the Southern District of Iowa under George W. Bush's administration. He then ran for U.S. Senate the year that Tom Harkin retired. He sought the Republican nomination that, of course, Joni Ernst won. He didn't do very well in his campaign. He finished fourth in a field of five candidates. And then he went, he was working for a nonprofit for a while, and then he was on CNN. He was a regular commenter on CNN defending Donald Trump. And about a year into Trump's presidency, he was appointed to be chief of staff to then Attorney General Jeff Sessions. I mean, it was a big step up for somebody who had never, who hadn't really worked in the Justice Department in Washington. He'd only worked as a U.S. attorney a decade or so earlier. So he, after a year or so of working for Jeff Sessions, the president fired Sessions as attorney general shortly after the 2018 elections and appointed Matt Whitaker as acting attorney general. He only held that position for about 3 months, but then he proceeded to write a book endorsing the idea that there was a deep state undermining the Trump presidency. And so he's been a very public defender of President Trump and of all things Trump. And he's now involved in a new project, a legal project that they're fashioning themselves as like the conservative mirror image of the ACLU, where they're going to be filing lots of lawsuits against the Biden administration. And Matt Whitaker is one of the founding board members, along with Mark Meadows, who's Trump's former chief of staff, and Stephen Miller, who's Trump's a former senior advisor. So many people believe that if Chuck Grassley retires and doesn't seek an eighth term, that Matt Whitaker is going to try to run for Senate again. And I think that he's pretty well positioned to get Trump's endorsement if there is an open primary. Now, I don't think Matt Whitaker is going to run against Chuck Grassley. So if Grassley doesn't retire, then I think Matt Whitaker is going to be doing something else for the next little while. But he comes back, he speaks periodically to Republican events in Iowa and tries to keep his name and face out there. So he's just somebody I have my eye on.
Maybe he'll come and join us on Capitol Week. Right. Some afternoon or evening. As our regular listeners can tell, we are on a little bit longer right now than we normally are. And the reason is this is a special program. And our friend Mike Murphy, who is often heard on Local Talk on KHOI Radio and is our wonderful engineer who puts Laura and me on the air every show we have, he's going to join us now. Mike, welcome to Capitol Week.
Well, thanks. I'm excited to be here.
We're excited to have you.
Great. So the reason we're doing this is because KHOI has started our spring fund drive. We kicked it off with a wonderful concert at Stevens Auditorium last night with Chad Elliott and Bo Ramsey. And we did bring in some funds, but not as much as we need. And that's what we're coming to you for right now. In campaign finance terms, we're looking for a couple of money bombs to help get this going. And we're asking people to go to khoifm.org and click on that yellow Become a Member Donor button and help support wonderful programs like Capitol Week. We started this program in the beginning of February, is that right?
Yes. Yeah, 15 weeks ago.
That's right. And it's a roaring success. I mean, it's, first of all, we didn't know it. I didn't know it, at least, that there was such a void in our schedule that this filled. This really is useful to us here at the station and useful to our listeners to help fill in what's going on in the state capitol? What's going on in Iowa politics? And we've got two terrific people doing this program. And I'd like to maybe talk a little bit about that. And I could be talking to these folks while you are going to khoifm.org, going to that yellow Become a Member Donor button and clicking on that. And making a contribution, a $60 membership comes out to $5 a month. It's swift, it's secure, and as good as this program sounds, it'll sound even better when you have your own stake in the program, when you become more of a stakeholder. So we've got two terrific people putting this program on. And I want to maybe start with you, Dennis. You have a long and storied career in journalism, in television, in radio and in academia, in teaching journalism. And you've written a couple of books. Journalism is something that's near and dear to you. When you were a little kid, did you want to be a journalist when you grew up, or when did you first get the bug?
When I was a little kid, I wanted to be a bus driver. I thought the smell of diesel was so good that being behind the wheel for 40 years would be a heck of a career. But then when I went to college, I grew out of that a little bit. I wanted to be a geography teacher until I found my campus radio station. And I became a disc jockey on the campus radio station and suddenly realized after 6 months I was having fun. I'd always listened to rock radio when I was growing up, but I'd already said all I had to say about the music. I had nothing more to say. And so I gravitated toward journalism and became a journalism major. And I have loved it for 40 years, graduated with a degree in journalism. And you're very kind to talk about a storied career. I'm not sure how much of a story it is. I've been so fortunate in my life. Started out as a radio news director, my first job out of college in a very small town called Susanville, California, working 70 hours a week, making $500 a month, $398.50 take home. Living next to the Greyhound bus terminal, because that's all I could afford. And then
Buses are in your blood, aren't they?
They're in my blood. There you go. Then I went bankrupt after about 6 months, went back to the university in Fresno and got an MA, started working on a master's degree in journalism. And while I was back there, I was so lucky. I had worked part-time during school at a television station as a floor director, announcer director, all of this. But because I'd been a news director in radio, they hired me for a part-time job to be the youngest TV reporter in Fresno on the number one station in town. Well, just for a few weeks while the reporter who was there had to go off the air because he was running for a school board office. And under federal law, you could not be on the air if you were running for school board. You remember those days, Mike. And so that lasted for 5 years, full-time job. But I was so lucky, got a full-time job and then started moving around the country. And over those years, just to cut this short, because I'm certainly not the only one you want to talk to tonight. Laura has this fantastic background. I was so fortunate to be able to work in Fresno in television news, Phoenix, Atlanta, Detroit, Buffalo, San Francisco, Los Angeles. Covered some very major stories, covered presidential elections, produced convention coverage, national convention coverage, produced coverage of the 1989 San Francisco earthquake, the biggest earthquake I hope I'm ever in and never want to do it again. Along the way, taught journalism at Iowa State University for a couple of years, assistant professor of journalism. I have written a couple of books on a program called NBC Monitor, which was a weekend show heard on WHO radio and across the nation for 20 years. A great show. You're nodding your head, Mike. Remember that one? Mm-hmm. Monitor on NBC.
Yeah.
So it is a pleasure doing this. Oh, and I should say, radio's always been my first love. We had been on the road for 20 years, going to all the cities I mentioned. Finally decided it was messing up our kids' education, and so we decided to slow it down. And we went back to where we started in Central California, and I became a program director in radio, host on NPR's Morning Edition locally, and then became the anchor and reporter for KMJ Radio, the number one radio station in town. I'd spent the last 10 years doing that. We came back to Ames because we loved Ames from our teaching days. We have a condominium on Duff Avenue, a block and a half from KHOI Radio. We come back to every summer, and we will this summer. And found out about KHOI Radio and volunteered. I volunteered several years ago. I didn't know what I could do. And Ursula said, why don't you do news? And so here we are Mondays and Fridays doing news on Local Talk. And the delight that I have in doing that is almost beyond my ability to tell you, covering news around Iowa and around Ames and being on this show for the last 15 weeks with Laura, whom I just met after the election. We did a broadcast. Remember, Laura, the day after the election. And working with Laura and talking with her about what's going on, we both follow the legislature in different ways. She covers it so close and has for years. I'm following it through a variety of news media sources on a daily basis. But interacting with her on this show the last 15 weeks has been a sheer delight. And Laura, you are the smartest person I think I've ever met who's covered the state legislature. And I met a lot of people. You are a delight to work with. And I mean that.
Yeah.
Thank you. Dennis is modest. Dennis is an award-winning. He has an award-winning career. But I want to say I really appreciate that KHOI has carved out this space to talk in depth about legislative happenings. I mean, you are never going to find on commercial radio anything like this show. That's for sure. So I really do hope listeners will support KHOI because the programming that you get on community radio, I mean, there just isn't space for it on commercial radio.
Absolutely right. And the quality of the programming on this station, the diversity of it, you'll never see on a commercial station. And I'll just say this. In the 15 weeks you and I have been on the air, Laura, when Ursula Rudenberg, the station manager, asked us to do the show, she just said, okay, you guys do it. We do this. We produce our own show. We talk about it during the week. No one has ever said we have to talk about anything. We just agree, I think, amazingly so, on what the important stories are. And that's the beauty of this show, that it's our show, and I love doing this with you. I really do.
Yes, and we have a lot of editorial freedom, and I really appreciate the questions that you ask and that you're following it closely. That it helps me to set some guideposts for myself.
Well, now talk about yourself, Laura. I know Mike wants you to talk about yourself.
Well, it's funny. If you had met me 20 years ago, I thought I was going to spend my career writing about Russian politics. I got interested in Russia when I was in college. Gorbachev was in power in the Soviet Union, and it was the absolute peak of American college students studying the Russian language. And I studied Russian history and literature, went to graduate school after that for a degree in Russian studies. And I came back to the U.S. for a year, had a job unrelated to the field, and I really wanted to get back into the Russian field. And I got a big break in 1995, working with a group of people covering contemporary Russian politics. Boris Yeltsin was president at that time. It was very exciting. My beat was mostly domestic politics, so campaigns and elections, parliamentary politics. I developed an interest in the Russian media. So I did some media criticism, and I covered the 1995-1996 election cycle, working for something called the Open Media Research Institute, which was based in Prague. It was funded by George Soros. And if you know anything about George Soros, he tends to get excited about projects for 2 or 3 years, and then he moves on and does something else. And that's what happened with the Open Media Research Institute. We were operational for about 2 years and 3 months before he shut down the funding. But I was able to move over to Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, which was also located in Prague, and they hired a skeleton staff of research analysts, including myself. I was continuing to cover Russian politics more broadly, but I still, my first love was always Russian domestic politics. So I worked for Radio Free Europe. I wasn't on the radio broadcasting side. I was writing for English language publications that appeared online, but I really enjoyed that job. I love my colleagues. I did that full time for a little under 2 years, then on a freelance basis for a number of years after that. So I covered 3 election cycles in Russia. And after Vladimir Putin took power, I had gone back to graduate school. I was working on a dissertation, and I was still freelancing for Radio Free Europe. And I really thought after I finished my dissertation, I was going to go try to find some kind of full-time work writing about Russia. But the Russian domestic politics scene really declined in the early 2000s, and the elections weren't as interesting. The parliament became more of a rubber stamp parliament. And so after the 2003-2004 election cycle in Russia, I just thought, you know, there's really no future for me doing this. And I took a break from writing. I had young kids, and by around 2006-2007, I was really missing the political writing, but I didn't want to get back into Russia. And so I started poking around on political blogs, mostly national blogs. Then I started nosing around the Iowa political blog scene, small as it was at that time. And there were a couple of college students from Iowa State and Drake who started this thing called Bleeding Heartland in early 2007. And I think I was registered user number 9 on Bleeding Heartland. It was a community blog, and I was a regular commenter and occasionally wrote a guest post. And then one of the founders, Drew Miller, graduated from Iowa State and got hired by the Iowa Democratic Party. And the job he was doing was in IT, and he wasn't allowed to do any outside blogging. And he had gone to a lot of work to create this website. So he knew nothing about my writing background. He had no idea I had a professional writing background. But because I was an active user on the site, he emailed me to say, do you want to be a front pager on this Bleeding Heartland site? I had a toddler and a preschooler, but I thought, well, that would be kind of fun. So I could do that in my spare time. And then as my kids got older and were in school full time, it turned into sort of my out of control hobby. And then really a full time or a lot of weeks more than a full time job. So I really enjoy, for me, it's a way to cover, instead of Russian campaigns and elections, I cover Iowa campaigns and elections. And instead of the Russian parliament, I cover the Iowa legislature. And I have my beats on social and environmental issues that I'm interested in. And I do even a little bit of media criticism as well. So I really enjoy, I love the editorial freedom of that. And I really appreciate that KHOI has created the space for me to also do some reporting for a radio audience. That's something that I didn't do even when I was at Radio Free Europe. I wasn't someone who regularly appeared on the radio. So this has been really fun for me.
So I want our listeners, and I appreciate both of you talking, because it's important that our listeners know the caliber of people that are doing this program. Dennis, you wrote a book called Monitor, the Last Great Radio Program. Now that we have Capital Week on the air, I think you're going to have to revise that title to maybe the penultimate great radio program, because
You're probably right. And I will honestly tell you, aside from the fact that I enjoy immensely working with Laura on this broadcast, I don't think you're going to find this broadcast on any other radio station. Really, in the time we have, mostly a half an hour in this time slot, Laura comes up and analyzes this legislature as well as anybody you're going to see, read, or hear in Iowa. And trust me, I read all the newspapers in Iowa, and I watch KCCI television. I'm on top of it. Laura does a great job. And Laura, you are to be congratulated for what you're doing.
I think you both are. And in the remaining couple minutes, I want to remind our listeners how easy it is to be a part of Capital Week, be a part of KHOI. You're already listening. I'm asking you to graduate to the next step and to be a supporter. And community radio is not a spectator sport. It takes a community. And that's what I'm asking you to do. If you could go to khoifm.org and click on that yellow Become a Member donor button, that would give us a little more oomph to take this a little bit further. You know, I like to say we do need, KHOI needs to survive, but more than that, we want to thrive. And so as good as, and you guys did a wonderful job of explaining how all the wonderful programming on here, as good as it is, we want to be better. And that only happens with community support. So we would like you to go to that website, khoifm.org, and make that contribution. There's no one here to answer the office line right now, but you could leave a voicemail at 515-292-2878. But please go now, khoifm.org. Support this wonderful program. We've got so many great programs on this station. It's entirely in your hands right now. Guys, thank you so much for what you do, and thanks for sharing a little bit more about yourselves. This has been absolutely wonderful. And
thank you for the opportunity and also the editorial freedom. It's very important.
Okay.
And we're out of time, Laura, so I think we have to say goodnight. Thank you all for the privilege of your time and listening, and have a great week, everybody.